This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Now, in the absence of Mark Twain and Kurt Vonnegut and Chuck Jones and Jonathan Swift and Brian O'Nolan and Carl Krauss and many others, we have with us here tonight George Saunders. Now, to read, I'd read articles by George in, I think, several in dentists, superior dental waiting rooms, old copies of The New Yorker and that sort of thing. But I've had a concentrated 3 days of reading George, and it is to be entertained and confronted and enchanted and disassembled in some cases. Those of you who've read about Phil will know what I mean about disassemblage. And to be with one of the great satirists of the age. But don't be put off. Not all satirists make you laugh out loud. You know, I never got a laugh out of The Handmaid's Tale once. And 1984, likewise. But George does make you think and laugh out loud at the same time. And most outrageously of all, at any moment when you're least expecting it, he can make your heart stop and your synapses stall with some sort of eerily beautiful observation. Which goes to say we could put the tag of satirist aside and we'd still have a brilliant writer. You might have seen his work in those magazines like Harper's and McSweeney's and The Guardian for a while, and you might have bought his collections of novellas and short stories. That work won him a dozen or more prizes and an election to the Academy of the Humanities, and has made him a star of American literature. And now he has written a novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. And about this novel, mainly, I want to talk to him tonight. No, I want him to talk to us tonight. So would you please welcome him to Northmont. Thank you. Thank you. Now, George, I have to ask you, because every American passing through any city elsewhere in the world will be asked this question. As far as I can tell, there's no escaping it, so let's get it out of the way. Those of you who've got the question ready, cross it off your lists, because it's not going to be accepted, because I've asked it already. And I will be opening it up to questions later on. The question is, could Andrew Jackson have stopped the Civil War?
I'm kind of tired of talking about that one.
Or was it sort of a bridge too far, do you think?
Yeah. We have to call Frederick Douglass and ask him.
The same for Napoleon, I imagine he couldn't have done anything about it. But that's enough Trump for now, okay? We won't do anything.
Amen.
But it does... there's another thing I wanted to ask you about. I didn't mention that George also teaches at Syracuse University. And he studied there, I understand. And this... I could read out a dozen passages at random... from this novel or from any of the stories, and I'd be left asking the question, can an imagination like this be somehow taught or encouraged, cultivated? Can you teach sensibility? In other words, can you teach writing? And do you take 68-year-old students, I suppose? Tell us about teaching writing.
Sure. Well, at Syracuse, where I teach, we get about 650 applications a year for six spots. Yeah, and the spots are fully funded, and they get about a $20,000 U.S. stipend. So at that level, you're not really teaching writing. They're already wonderful. Mm-hmm. So what we do is you take these people who are already incredibly talented, and you try to urge them up into that zone where they're doing the thing that only they could do. And that tends to be, I think for me, it's a lot of close line editing that kind of morphs into psychological work. So, you'll see somebody who's very good at everything, but sort of hasn't found the one thing that she does the best. And so you have 3 years to kind of watch and see why that is, and poke and prod a little bit in the line editing. So it's not really teaching writing. It's taking people who are already great and trying to make them freak out a little bit, you know, trying to push them into the area where they go, what did I just do? You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So. Well, can I just, there's a thing, there are sort of vaults of imagination in this book, which are really out of this world. Sorry, cliche like that, line edit, you know, straight. but you're dealing in ghosts, so you're going to have to put up with it. I wonder, when you get out there, it happened to me when I was about 11, I think, for about 10 minutes, and then it's never happened again. You get into a sort of world that is sort of entirely organic, it seems.
Yes.
And it grows of itself, mushroom-like.
Right.
Is that? I mean, that's what it feels like rereading your words.
Yeah, I always people say, oh, you have such a weird imagination. And you say, oh, thank you, you know, but I think imagination, I don't feel like that's a thing for me, but I think the discipline of revising really closely for a long time, then what happens is there's a logical world that you've made that is actually very confining. It's not free at all. It's quite confining. So once you've made that confinement, you might find that at a given point in the narrative, you have three choices, tightly, you know, conscribes choices. One of those is going to seem daring, but you wouldn't get there without the tight discipline beforehand. So for me, that whole thing is enacted by like really obsessive revision, going over it again and again and again until you kind of rule out the easy choices and you make a logical system where the reader looks over at you and says, yeah, I guess I'm with you. I've agreed to everything so far. Okay. You know, and then when a really crazy thing happens, the effect I really love is when you make an absolutely crazy thing happen and the reader has no choice but to go along with it. And I think that happens almost through sort of an algebraic logic along the way. You know, it's the crazy moment of imagination is actually tightly scripted in a certain way, you know, I think. By the time you get there, it doesn't seem crazy. I mean, for example, in this book, I stumbled into this convention that when a ghost co-occupies the space with you, the ghost can read your mind. And it was actually just kind of an error I made. I just thought, oh, that's weird. The kid just walked through his father. Huh. And then the son actually mimicked or sort of ventriloquized his father. So then, okay, you've made that convention. So then imagination, so-called, is really just remembering that you established that convention. And then 80 pages later, when you have two men co-occupying the same space, you have to honor the fact that you've done that, you know. So it looks crazy, but actually you're sticking to your own set of rules in a certain way.
See, Buster Keaton would probably agree with exactly that sort of... Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Those seeming casual pratfalls have actually been carefully rehearsed. And
yes.
At some physical cost, often, apparently. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's very hard to believe that the brief and frightening reign of Phil... I mean, you read that... I mean, here's a man whose brain is attached to a rack that it falls off very frequently. And it is incredible after about 20 pages that you accept that entirely. I mean, it's a freak of nature, that work. Yeah. The inner Hornerites and the outer Hornerites. Yeah. Has anybody read it here? The brief? Yes, you must. And it is impossible. I tried it three times to read the section where he can't find his brain and it falls off and his speech starts to go awry. You cannot read that without laughing loudly, if not choking. It's truly brilliant. Now, on Lincoln. Lincoln occupies an extraordinary place in America,
yes.
Does he not? I mean, and there are times there where I think you're reminding us that he may be in the Bardo permanently, that he actually exists in some space in the American mind, which is a kind of rough equivalent of the Bardo, that he's never left.
Yeah.
He's almost godlike, I think.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything is referred to Lincoln. In fact, if he wanted to say why the present president, whose name we won't mention, is so horrible, it's because he's so horribly unlike a Lincoln.
Yeah. You know, working on this book, every American has this idealized, saintly idea of Lincoln. And when you start reading about him, it's beautifully complicated. He actually was very ambitious. They say kind of a little bit personally cold. He didn't have a lot of close friends. There are moments when he was just like any human being, full of self-doubt and everything. But the one thing that I really loved about him was that under all this pressure he was under, you know, 10 or 20,000 people a day dying because of his mistakes, the press just nailing him, calling him an ape and insulting his wife and everything. Through that whole period, he, I think you can argue that he became more spacious as a human being. He became more curious about other people's experience. He became more tender-hearted, actually, even for his enemies. And I think that's why he comes up so much now, because you see a regime that is marked by decreasing tenderness, you know, excluding groups of people, distorting the language in order to marginalize people and frighten people. And that doesn't sit well with a lot of us, because we have that high example of Lincoln. And even if you sort of take off the saintliness of Lincoln, I think he made more progress as a human being in the last 5 years than almost anyone I've read about. You know, he went from being kind of a casual provincial racist of his time to having a view of equality that we still haven't caught up with, actually, you know. So you love him for that reason, because under duress he became more loving. And now in the present climate, under duress, the love is going out of the room so rapidly. So I think he's...
Yes.
Yeah.
And he in the book, he actually, we see, well, this is one of the things about the book, that there are real sources and sources which you are not real, that you've imagined or you've put in there. And you're not going to tell us which are real and which are not.
I will, but it costs.
I'll speak to you later. But there are times, and I don't know whether they're real or imagined sources, but where Lincoln's character is actually projected onto Willie, the son. I'd love to know whether they're real or imagined, because if they're real, I mean, it's as if something's actually quite serious is happening there. That they're saying, well, you know, that Willie is like his father in the...
No, that one is real. I mean, that was one of the things people said, is of the Lincoln children, Willie was the most like Willie, Willie was the most like Abe, the most articulate, charming, intelligent. And they actually kind of, well, they didn't really like Robert that much, the older son, and Tad was sort of a little bit of a slow, and so Willie was kind of the one in which they had invested most of their hopes. That's true, yeah.
But the other interesting thing about it is that he, you know, there's this fabulous man who is godlike in his humanity. You know, that's the strange thing about it. But who, in a modern context, and it comes out in the book, is a sort of neglectful father. A man who's working too hard at his job, that his ambition is for himself is greater than his care for his children. And Willie is this sort of touchstone of his failure.
Yeah. Well, he took the kind of the fatherly stance that says, just leave him alone. One of the quotes is, and this is an actual quote, it said that Lincoln paid no mind to his children. If they had shit in his hat, he would have laughed and thought it wonderful, you know.
Yeah.
So I like that. I think that's good, you know.
Well, it was a hat that invited that sort of action, actually, wasn't it? Really? But he, it's a beautiful line. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Which only makes him this is what sort of drives you mad about Lincoln. He's so marvelous. You think, you know, when are my 5 years coming, when I'll grow sort of a human being?
And I think he died at 54, so we kind of missed our window
too late,
there.
Too late. But there's also something about him, I know this is off the track a bit, but if you stand and read that second inaugural speech on the walls of the memorial, that is such a sort of such an intellectual agony that it expresses. I mean, I think it's the greatest piece of writing I've ever read. I think it's better than Gettysburg. And he's trying to deal with God, in whom he only has a faint belief, I suspect, or a half belief, or he doesn't know quite what it is.
That's right. He's trying to posit God by watching the things that are happening and saying, since I can't imagine God, I have to see what he's doing. And it looks like God wants us to keep killing each other until we reverse the stain of slavery. And you know, yeah. But this is the other thing. You know, his writing was so beautiful, and he was a person who reasoned by revision. By writing anyway. We don't know, but he there's a famous scrap of paper that he never published, but it's basically a syllogistic proof that slavery is wrong and therefore racial equality is necessary. Mm-hmm. And he just, almost like a mathematical proof, he jotted it down one day and put it aside, and that was a pivot in his thinking. But he actually did it by proving it, by writing it, you know, which is, you know.
Yeah. And there's that strange thing that if he'd actually won that earlier election that he was beaten in by that other Douglas person, mm-hmm. he would never have been president.
Right.
And what would the United States be like without Lincoln? Can you answer that question in a few
words?
Yes,
but I can't. I have to, you know. I mean, you know, it's funny. Actually, I'll tell you that one of the funny things that's going on right now in my head is the idea that, you know, when you're raised in the States, what you think is we're a great, righteous country and we just fuck up every now and then, you know, like every 2 years or something, you know. And now recently, you know, you kind of think, wait a minute. Maybe there's something funny about us, you know. That I mean, the chickens are coming home to roost a little bit, and it's actually very unsettling, you know, to think that the latent violence that we've always had, the latent banality, a sort of aggressive banality that's underneath the surface, is now kind of blossoming, and it's a creepy feeling, actually, you know, to look at a lot of things that you thought were fundamentally good, but every so often went into the ditch. And then you're like, wait a minute, maybe we were in the ditch all along and we just occasionally came up onto the road, you know?
Yeah.
I hope that's not true, but it's a, you know.
Well, I've been trying to keep away from the subject of Trump, but we'll get this last bit out of it with, because you traveled with the Trump contingent during the election. I don't know what else to ask you except what was it like?
Well, it was actually it was very wonderful because I was not with the campaign, but with the crowds. So I just go into the crowd and blend. Mm-hmm. And really, those are kind of my people. I'm from the South Side of Chicago, and on both sides of my family, I think about 80% of the people who voted for Trump. And before this, you know, in my short stories, they're all about working class white people and the way that capitalism is constantly, you know, shitting on them basically, mm-hmm. and kind of anti-corporate. Stance. So to be there was, I thought I would go in, the plan was go in, cherry pick 3 or 4 terribly racist things, come back and type it up and get the money, you know. And then, but when you go out, this is the great thing about nonfiction is you go out with a stupid idea and then hopefully the world overturns the stupid idea. So I was out there about a day and everyone was courteous to me and I would always say, you know, hi, I'm liberal. A little left of Gandhi, you know, and they were, oh, you're kidding, you know, oh, come on, we'll talk, and a lot of them, I mean, really, this is kind of a joke, but not much. The polarization is such that a lot of them really had never talked to a person that would self-describe as a liberal. So one woman said to me, okay, do you liberals really think the government should run every aspect of our lives? I'm like, no. You know, and so and it was. I guess what was confusing was the people were very happy to talk and very friendly and sweet and funny, and I had the sense that it would be very easy to throw them under the bus. That many of them hadn't been interviewed before, you know, and also the whole mythology at the time was that these were all lower middle class, non college educated people out of Steinbeck who were being crushed by the system. Kind of true, but also a lot of pretty affluent people who watch too much right-wing TV. So anyway, it was very, very complicated, and the beauty of that piece was it got rejected twice by the New Yorker, almost 3 times. And it was so hard for me to tell the truth that the first draft was an operatic libretto. I actually submitted it to the New Yorker in that form. and at one point, there was some angels who were actually immigration activists were flying over the rally. So that was an awkward rejection phone call, you know.
Do you think that's why they rejected it, or because they weren't going to have anything that was sympathetic to Trump?
No, it wasn't that. It was just stupid as hell.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but also, you know what, David Remnick, who's a great editor, he called after that and he said, you know, I really appreciate that you're being sympathetic, but you seem to be avoiding the difficult work of analysis. Like, you know, is that bad? You know, yeah. So, but I was, because I couldn't quite find the angle. And actually, what happened was my wife, who's here tonight, said to me, "You're trying to solve this thing, and really, what you are there to do is describe it. You're a fiction writer. You can describe." And that was an incredible liberation to just say, "Yeah, I don't have to come down on one side or the other. The piece can be as ambiguous and confused as I am. All I have to do is describe the things that I saw that the people who didn't have a chance to see." And that what that was basically incredible violence on both sides. Mm. Incredible angst and anger and stupidity and violence on both sides. And so in a way, you could sort of say, as in a novel, let me assume that truth is actually an elaborate system of contradiction. The Trump people are violent, so are we. You know, the Trump people are sweethearts, so are we. And just put it all up in the air and let it sit there. So not to solve the problem, but as Chekhov says, art doesn't solve problems, but it has to formulate them correctly. So at that point, I felt like I could finish. So then you could judge harshly and truthfully, and then at some other point, you could counterbalance with something else and feel like you'd been fair, you know?
Yeah. But
he still won.
Yeah, and it raises an interesting question. I mean, in support of what you say, that out of the 10 trillion pieces of analysis that were written, probably 3 or 4 would now stand up, whereas your piece, I suspect, will stand up a lot longer. Mm-hmm. It is a problem with this analysis. You're wrong all the time.
Yeah.
Especially writers.
Yeah. Well, but I think one of the things I'm trying to get into my own head is that this is, obviously a confusing time. Nobody knows what the hell is going on, no matter how much they say they do. But for artistic people, readers and writers, I think part of the job is to sort of fess up that we don't know what's happening. And I feel like, to the extent that I feel outraged about it, that's on me. You know, if your dog bites you in the groin, you didn't know your dog. You know, it's not, the dog is actually blameless, you know. I mean, you know. Yeah. So I think that part of it, I think for, there was a period of complete liberal.
But if he bites you twice in the groin,
that's right.
The same place.
That's on him, yeah. And three, I don't even, you're just. Yeah. But I think there was a bit of a reaction of panic and sort of like, oh, it's outrageous. And then I feel like now I'm trying to get back to work and say, all right, this, you didn't know your country, but you should, you could. Mm. Now go back out and talk to people and try to understand it in a way that doesn't, it really isn't an aberration from logic. It's just that, I was not connected enough to see it, or, as many people weren't. But that's the job, I think, of a fiction writer or of an artist is to just always be willing to have his habitual thoughts overturned and go back in and, try again.
Can I ask you it's a sort of dumb question, but you mentioned Chekhov, and I hadn't mentioned Chekhov myself in my list of writers that you remind me of from time to time. In fact, the Bardo, it reminded me of a dozen writers, but also it was... It strikes me as being like a sort of early Renaissance painting with thought bubbles and speech bubbles. It's like there's something medieval about it, and it's not just the ghosts. It's that the world is incredibly complex, and we're trying to make sense of it in a very simplistic way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because we all come out like simpletons when we're trying to make sense of anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's by the by. But I did want to ask you, do you believe in ghosts?
Yeah. I'd like to. Do you?
I'm with the Irishman who, when the anthropologist asked him, he said, "Of course not, but they're there."
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's an essential difference.
I read a great quote. Philip K. Dick said, "Reality is that which, when you cease believing in it, doesn't go away."
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah. Can't argue with that. So you sort of believe in them?
Yeah, I actually do. I don't. I think I don't have the ability to see them, but I do believe in them. Yeah. Yeah. I believe in him as a literary device for sure.
I figured that.
Yeah.
They're fantastic guys. You get to love them in this. Yeah.
Well, you know what I like about Ghost, and I've used them for a long time, is just that the, we're sitting here and the, kind of the realism says there's 300 nice people in a room, and but we know that these people will die. Some of them, I guess all of them. And then, but also that there were other people here 100 years ago. And that's actually quite true. It's quite true that this room is infused with all that energy or that memory. So I think in order to be a true realist, you sometimes have to break that fourth wall a little bit and just to, because somehow the true stakes of life and the drama and the craziness of our situation on Earth is, from my point of view, not really representable by realism, at least as I practice it. So in order to sort of shake things up, it's like a dead person is very useful, to get...
And I love the way they leave at the end, the Earth. They sort of explode and disappear and fight furiously to stay. Yeah. And it did worry me that Volman, if you're not aware of this, Volman is sort of perpetually tumescent. And he goes...
The eternal dream.
He goes off in that state, presumably. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
You cannot get that out of your mind.
Well, one of the things that I had read some Tibetan texts, and one of the ideas is that when you die, or when we were alive, the mind is quite crazy, but it's dampened by being in the physical body. And some of these texts say that when you die, it's like a horse being let off a tether, and whatever habits you develop in this life, they get supersized, which is a scary notion. So this guy, Volman, had just before, he had been married to a much younger woman, and they had not consummated the marriage because she found him kind of repulsive. And so he was a nice guy and put it off. And then on, say, Wednesday... she said, I think it's probably time for us. In other words, like tomorrow night, it's on. And then he died. So,
when he was gone. Yeah. Well, bear that in mind as you go about your lives. Well, there's a bit, I want you to read something, George, because it takes reading. And I was going to have you reading Phil when his brain falls off, but there was a section here. I'm sorry, there's a hiatus. Is there a part you'd like to read?
No.
You'd like to read it all. There's an absolutely beautiful passage. I won't try and... Well, you could read some of all the different voices, but I was just... Could you read... Oh, no, that's a bit grim.
The grocery list.
Yeah, there's a... well, maybe this.
I can't wait to see what it is.
No.
I'm hoping it's some Tolstoy.
You can see all these little stickers in here and there. But just read from Willie Was Wasting Away. There.
Okay,
there.
How much? 20 pages?
We'll know from looking at their faces.
All right, just someone make a farting noise when it's time to quit. So the way the book is set up, it's a lot of white space. That's how I wrote my first novel. But basically, there's a quote and then there's an attribution afterwards. So I guess I'll do the attributions afterwards. So this is just a section of, I guess, mostly true bits describing Willie. Willie Lincoln was wasting away. Epstein. Ibid. The days dragged wearily by and he grew weaker and more shadow-like. Keckley, Ibid. Lincoln's secretary, William Stoddard, recalled the question on everyone's lips. Is there no hope? Not any, so the doctors say. By Doris Kearns Goodwin. At about 5 o'clock this afternoon, I was lying half asleep on the sofa in my office when Lincoln's entrance aroused me. Well, Nikolai, said he, choking with emotion, my boy is gone. He's actually gone. And bursting into tears, turned and went into his own office. John G. Nicolay, edited by Michael Burlingham. The death was only moments ago. The body lay upon the bed, the coverlet thrown back. He wore the pale blue pajamas. His arms lay at his sides. The cheeks were still inflamed. Three pillows lay in a heap on the floor. The small side table was askew. as if roughly pushed aside. Account of Sophia Lennox made. I assisted in washing him and dressing him and then laid him on the bed when Mr. Lincoln came in. I never saw a man so bowed down with grief. He came to the bed, lifted the cover from the face of his child, gazed at it long and lovingly and earnestly, murmuring, "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven, but then we loved him so. It is hard, hard to have him die." Keckley Ibid. He was his father's favorite. They were intimates, often seen hand in hand. Keckley Ibid, account of Nathaniel Parker Willis. He was his father over again, both in magnetic personality and in all his gifts and tastes. Ruth Painter Randall. He was the child in whom Lincoln had invested his fondest hopes, a small mirror of himself, as it were, to whom he could speak frankly, openly, and confidingly. Tyrone Fillion. Will was the true picture of Mr. Lincoln in every way, even to carrying his head slightly inclined toward his left shoulder. Burlingham Ibid. One feels such love for the little ones, such anticipation that all that is lovely in life will be known by them, such fondness for that set of attributes manifested uniquely in each. Mannerisms of bravado, of vulnerability, habits of speech and mispronouncement and so forth, the smell of the hair and head, the feel of the tiny hand in yours, and then the little one is gone, taken. One is thunderstruck that such a brutal violation has occurred in what had previously seemed a benevolent world. From nothingness there arose great love. Now, its source nullified, that love, searching and sick, converts to the most abysmal suffering imaginable. Mrs. Rose Maland. That is funny. That is funny.
Yeah.
No.
Thank you for that, because it took me quite a while to get to know how to read this book, you know, how to get the rhythm of the reading, yeah. You know, those spaces. Don't think because there are big spaces that it's a quick read.
Yeah.
It's actually quite a slow read.
Yeah. People are saying that this book actually takes about 30 pages to get the hang of, or not. Some people just say, "I can't do it." But after about 30 pages, supposedly it teaches you how to read it, and you start to kind of go. So that was kind of the bargain. Was when I was working on it, I had this feeling, this is really crazy. I'm not sure if people can read it. But you sort of take the chance that if you front load the difficulty, then the person acquires the skills to read it, and hopefully you take them to some higher place by the end of it once they get the hang of it.
That's very interesting. Did you think that at the beginning, or did you? Is it somewhere in the drafts that you realized you had to put it up? You had to front load the difficulty, as you say.
Well, you know what? Actually, what the problem was, I'd heard this story 20 years ago. We heard this story that Lincoln had actually, when his son died, he had been so grief stricken that he had gone into the crypt a couple times, and some account said he'd actually held the body or somehow interacted with it. So I heard this many years ago, and I wanted to try it and didn't think I had the chops for it. It was too serious and too heavy. So then, about 2012, I thought, I'll give it a try. And you think, okay, how do we do this? And, okay, so maybe it's a third-person book. And you try it in your head. You know, it's like Lincoln walked into the graveyard. It was a dark and stormy night. You know, no, I can't do that. Then you think, maybe you'll do it in first person. So, you know, 4 score and 7 minutes ago, I did walk into, you know. So I mean, for me, part of the, when I'm trying to get a project going, the real barometer is if I can feel an enjoyable language kind of stockpiled behind me that I can draw on. So for all those years, I couldn't figure it out. But when I started thinking about monologues, then all of a sudden it came alive a little bit. So then you start putting the monologues in order, and it's really an open question of whether a reader could process it or not. And so I spent a whole lot of time on the first 30 pages to make sure that I wasn't being strange for the sake of being strange, wasn't being difficult for the sake of being difficult, but was really trying to super compress it. And at some point I thought, well, I would get it if I read it. And so then you just hope that there'll be enough people out there that take the chance with you, you know?
Yeah. They did. They are. There's another thing about it which is strange. I mean, original, as it undoubtedly is, and unique, it has one thing in common with American literature that Australian literature tends to not have, and Australian life and, you know, worldview, and that is a sort of religious dimension. It's like most American literature in having that dimension. I don't know quite why we lack it. I could go into it, but it's, I'm not going to. But do you agree? I mean, even secular America is a sort of religious America in some
ways. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know why. I mean, personally, I was a real crazy fanatic Catholic kid in Chicago, which is, and this was in the 60s, so Catholicism in Chicago in the 60s was like a triple whammy of guilt and self-loathing, and you know,
it's a bit like that in Melbourne, I believe, but I was a Protestant.
Yeah. But I mean, for me, it was very, I had some really beautiful experiences in the Catholic Church as a kid, almost kind of mystical experiences, and then had similar experiences with literature early, that I was a kind of a working class kid, read a lot of Steinbeck and Hemingway, and I just assumed that that's what writing was for, was to kind of show you how to live, or to be a moral examination. So for me, it was always those two things were kind of together. And and also, you know, I think, you know, as you get older, it becomes more clear that death actually will happen to even you, me. Mm-hmm. And so then I don't really see that everything isn't religious in that sense. You know, in other words, there's going to come a day when you'll be sick and you'll be tired and you'll be weak. So and there've already come days when your resources aren't up to living. Actually, you know, you're not smart enough, kind enough, wise enough. So to me, that's where the religious dimension comes in: is when you finally burn out of the idea that you're sufficient in and of yourself. Then you say, well, what else is there that can help me get through this life? And so I think this book was situated, on that spot where you say, how is it that you can be in this world? It seems like we're set up to love. That seems to be what we're meant to do. So find somebody to love, make babies, love those babies, love a set of friends. That all seems obvious. And then the train coming down the track is that anything that's conditional is going to get destroyed. Mm-hmm. And how in the world do you make a functional life out of those two things? Mostly what I do is I just pretend the second thing isn't true. You know, but every so often life, I had a thing a few years ago where I was on a plane coming out of Chicago, just relaxing and enjoying things and heading home. And we took off, and there was a sound like a minivan hitting the side of the plane. And the plane jumped, and black smoke started coming out of those little deals, you know. And there was a girls' softball team. They all started screaming. And then we started dropping, and I know Chicago, and I could see just where we were, and it was not near the airport at all. And I thought, oh shit, you know. And I'd always imagined that I would, and I was doing a lot of meditation at the time, and I thought I would be the one who sort of stood up and said, everyone, you know, it's been a good life, hasn't it? Let us now sing Kumbaya, and you know. And I just was saying, you know, it is possible to piss oneself. I really, you know. So that was really something, and I thought, you know, that every, in a sense, every minute that you're not worrying or anticipating death is kind of a stupid moment. You know, I was sitting there, there's a seat in front of me, I'm like, oh God, I have to get out of this body now, and that seat is going to do it, you know. And I was completely, I didn't think about anything, but I just was like, no, let's go back in time, start this over, you know. And actually in the middle of that, there was a 14-year-old boy sitting next to me, who I'd totally forgotten about. And all of a sudden I hear his voice, and he goes, sir, is this supposed to be happening? and that kind of broke the spell. But I'm in a, you know, and now that story's a big joke, but at the time it was not a big joke. So I really think that literature should be, has some role in just ritually, gently reminding us every day that that is where we are. And whatever we do during the course of the day ought to take that into account. And while I was writing the book, it went from feeling a little bit morbid to feeling very vital to go in every day and go, okay, in a graveyard, you know.
Yeah, Wonderful. What happened to the plane? You obviously,
it crashed,
down.
And the we crash. All yeah, we all died. No. Yeah. No. Actually, what happened?
That's what I've suspected all along.
It's been a beautiful dream ever since. But I dreamed. No, what happened was, they, and nobody was saying anything. It was just really quiet. And then we kept going down and down. And finally, the pilot came on, and he was very reassuring. He said, "Stay in your seat with the seatbelts on!" Like that. It was panic-stricken, you know. Yeah, and great. What happened is some geese had flown into the engine and destroyed it. And I guess geese often fly into engines, but they don't usually shut the engine down. Yeah. So he was able to turn around and get us back. And so, you know, we landed, and I said to the flight attendant, "That probably happens all the time." She said, "Not in 30 fucking years." Like that, you know.
Well, it's funny because I actually a lot of the time reading this, I was thinking it's rather like if you're talking to somebody who is going to die. I don't get to my age now. You've spoken to a few people who are on the edge of death, and it becomes very strange that the gap is like a cigarette paper thin. It's really like you're talking about just crossing over into something else.
Yeah.
And really, all the solutions, all the writing about that is not sort of desperately secular and ignoring it. I mean, it's actually you do end up in another kind of realm of if you like spirituality, or there's a better word for it, but a graveyard, if you like, with ghosts.
Yeah.
But it did feel as strange as that, like a conversation with someone who's just about to vanish. Now, we've got about 20 minutes left. Are there a lot of questions, I wonder? But no? Good. I guess the other thing about it is that if you, it's a wonderful reminder that, you know, that you can't, not only, you know, are you describing sort of, we live in America, Americans inhabit sort of parallel universes, it seems to me, and the great myth of political rhetoric is always, well, Obama said it perfectly, you know, there are no red states, no blue states, there's only the United States of America. I mean, that, he was actually saying, there are red states and blue states, and there are no United States of America. Yeah. We're all at each other's throats. It's a very tribal place, and it's culturally incredibly heterodox, and there's not much can be done about that. Mm. And it's now more tribal than ever before. But if I've lost my train of thought, damn it. I've lost it completely. It's gone. Well, forget about it. Forget it. That's just a statement I happen to make. yes. Yeah. I was also wondering whether the pilot of the plane, if he didn't say we are currently experiencing an issue, which is what
he was too afraid to even say that.
He couldn't get
that far.
No.
But one of the things about this book that I, you know, it started out being about death, but then what I loved about it was this might be sort of too technical, but the way that structurally with the monologues, you got to constantly be contradicting, you know. So there's a section in here where we're talking about the moon on a certain night, and just got to have 9 different contradictory descriptions of the moon. In the actual historical record, there are 7 different, at least 7 different descriptions of the color of Lincoln's eyes. And that seemed really beautiful to me, that if you really look back at history and try to say, well, what happened? You don't actually know, you know. And scientists are finding out now that if you, you know, when you think about your first kiss or whatever, every time you take that memory out of the rack, you change it a little bit. And you change it per your current system of belief. So there is literally not an objective truth in the past either. And when you start looking at the Civil War or anything that's that far away, there's not a truth. You know, there's only so that to me is an exciting idea about the novel in this sense. If we were going to try to write a novel about right now, what's the closest thing to a God's eye view of right now? I think it's 325 internal monologues all firing at once. That's the truth. And now, I mean, it'd be difficult to do, but in a room like this, there's a novel being written right now, which is every thought that's going on right now is presented simultaneously. That seems to me something to, you know, that's my next book. So so as you leave, if you would just make it on a note card, fill out.
Well, for a moment there, you brought me back to the little train of thought that I'd lost, but it's, the train has tended to keep going. But I think the point I wanted to make was that it is a sort of dialogue with a whole lot of people, but a whole lot of that sort of heterodoxy of American life then. And it is about the subjectivity of history. And in a funny kind of way, it's a sort of parallel for the Twitterverse and the endless barrage of opinion, most of it tribalized now. Yeah. And alternative facts and fake news
This book, you know, to be honest, the origin of this book was another novel that I threw away. And I started writing it maybe whenever sort of chat lines first were invented. And I stumbled across them and I thought, it looks so beautiful. You know, the way you'll have some incoherent, misspelled rant with a name at the top and then another incoherent rant not addressing the first one and with more insults, and then the thread skips and then four pages down I thought that looked poetic, really kind of beautiful. So when I went to think about this book, that was in my mind. You know, how could you make a sort of basically a chat line of the dead, and that beautiful moment when people talk past each other, you know, you ask this question and they don't answer, they answer out of their own thought bubble, a totally different thing. That seems to me the essence of human communication, isn't
yeah.
it? I had a writing teacher who said that, he gave me this great piece of writing advice, and it was basically that when you have two human beings talking, what's actually happening is person A has a thought bubble, a set of obsessions. Person B says, how is your day? He doesn't say, fine. He answers out of his thought bubble, you know, those stupid Latvians. You know, one thing about Latvians, I cannot say. Then person B, in answering, he doesn't answer that either. You know, my foot hurts. You know, so in a sense, he said this is the best way to write dialogue is to remember that there's two thought balloons, and really people aren't that interested in communicating.
Yeah.
You know, they're interested in discharging the cartoon balloon, and then they go home. You know, that's it.
That's right. But we're doing our best.
We're doing our best.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the Latvians. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's
a, yeah. It's like,
friggin' Latvians.
But I was thinking, I mean, in a way, Fox News has... you get the feeling that no one's actually thinking... Well, I suppose they are all in different... I love it when they have six people on the screen and someone's flown in a couple of thousand miles and she doesn't even get a chance to answer. She just goes home. Yeah. But it's just everyone's anxious to say something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the news. Which leads me to this question. How do you cope with anger?
I mean, how do you
cope with anger? I mean, when I think about it, if I read about Trump in the morning or even Malcolm Turnbull often, our own Prime Minister, it's anger that overwhelms me.
Yeah.
And it's quite a stretch to sort of get that into some sort of other...
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, in the States, I think what I'm hearing a lot of is people saying, I'm taking back my psyche, you know. There's that old idea that you enlarge that which you pay attention to. So if everybody is spending 20 hours a day thinking about anybody, that person gets more powerful, you know. Mm. And I actually, you know, in the States, I did a big tour, and we were talking to a lot of young artists right after the inauguration, and people were just traumatized by it. And, I kind of think, in a way, you just have to say, look, truth is still truth, cruelty is still cruelty, bullshit is still bullshit. And especially, I think you have to say that those of us who are, you know, live by the arts should double down on that. Because if anything, I can guarantee you that one of the reasons we're in the situation we're in at home is because we let the arts slip. You know, we artists consented to let it be a marginalized sort of casual, fun thing that we do for ornamentation. So what happens? Our everyday relation to complexity was lost. That's what art actually is. You read Faulkner, and you're reminded of what a high level of complexity we can actually deal with. Your language gets degraded. You start thinking, you know, this kind of Twitter type of chatter is actually language. Mm. Or when, you know, when a raccoon walks into the White House briefing office and Kellyanne Conway says, look at the duck. All right, it's a duck, you know. That all comes from, that's a degradation of language. And I think... you know, what I'm trying to do in my own mind is say, I'm not going to spend 24 hours a day thinking about the guy, and I'm going to double down on the things that I know are profound and compassion making, which is serious art, and speaking truthfully, you know, and yeah.
Well, on that magnificent note, we should open it to questions, I think. We have 11 minutes and 22 seconds.
Wow, that's good. How did you know? Oh, yeah.
Hi. What I absolutely loved about the structure of the book is that, it's the history and the ghosts and the quotes. And as someone who studied honest history, to me, the historical bits were like, when you are writing an essay, you get all the quotes and the themes and all the 360-degree angles together, and then you fill in the gaps. You don't. I love that. But please tell me, I've read that 85% of your sources were real. Is Sophie Lennox real? The maid. I don't think she was.
She's not. She's not. Yeah. No, that was, you know, actually what happened was I had a lot of fun with the ghosts early on. But then, you know, ghosts, they can do whatever you like. And I think one of my ideas about writing is that I'm trying to imagine you, my reader, as being my equal. And I'm watching you very closely to see how I'm doing. And at some point, as I was making those ghosts, I thought, you know, my imaginary reader is getting a little fed up with these constant ghosts. I had a writing teacher who said, George, in your career, you basically get three dream sequences. So don't use them up, you know. And a ghost is sort of a dream sequence. So at some point, I felt like I needed a factual spine, and that's where those history things came. But I think they're probably about, 75% are true, and then the other ones are...
Can you tell us which ones we got?
I can, yeah. Yeah, later. No, I mean, they were, you know, what happened was there was a crossroads moment where I thought for a long time that I would write a book that was absolutely faithful to Lincoln and the actual Tibetan Bardo, the geography of the graveyard. But then you get to that magic moment where you're like, okay, I can either be factual or I can be more thrilling, you know. And then you say, well, what is a novel meant for, really? It's actually not a compilation of facts, you know, that we know better. You know, the novel is trying to do... you know, it's trying to be beautiful, and it's also trying to lead us all, writer and reader both, to some higher transcendent truth that you can't get to just by lining up facts. We do that every day. You know, we know facts, but the novel is supposed to do something else. So I actually remember the day when I gave myself permission to start making those up, and it was just because I could feel the beauty, you know, that would be accessible if I let myself do that. So, yeah.
I want to ask about the Semplica girls from the 10th of December.
Hi.
Hi, over here.
Hi.
I just found that the most extraordinary image, and I just want to know, how did that idea come to you?
Thank you. It's embarrassing how it came to me. My wife and I had just bought a house in Syracuse, and we with a bigger house than we had before. We got our kids into this nice school, and so I had a dream, and in the dream... I got out of bed and walked to a non-existent window that looked out into our backyard. And in the backyard, there were four or five women who were all wearing white smocks, had long black hair, and they had, this is, welcome to my dream life, they had a wire run through their heads, and they were hanging up like paper dolls kind of in the backyard. And they were just hanging there with this wire. And the thing that made me want to write about it was, in the dream, the guy I was in the dream was not disgusted. He was like, I am so lucky. So lucky we could finally get to this point. You know, we could afford these. So I understood these women to be a lawn ornament, and I understood them in the dream to be sort of from third world countries. Yeah, so... good morning, you know. Yeah. And so that was kind of the you know, the seminal image. And I just thought, oh yeah, that would be something to write about, and kind of carried the idea around for a couple of years, and finally just tried it. So that, I mean, I've had two or three stories that came like that in dreams, and mostly they're stupid, like the penguin orgy. No, but sometimes a dream, it'll come in a quality of self-contradiction that I can't quite get rid of, and those I try to go ahead and write.
Is there anything we can take, you know? Is there something we can take that you get these good dreams?
Yeah. You don't want it. No, you really don't want it. I had one dream once where this little an ex-girlfriend showed up in the dream and just said very bluntly, I just want you to know, I have a baby. And I'm like, oh, good. No, she goes, no, a really smart baby.
I said, I'm really, fuck you, I have a baby. I said, all right. So then the baby in question crawls into the room, and the baby's going like, many of us do not fully understand the import of Einstein's findings. I'm like, wow, that is a really smart baby. And so then I look down, and she's the ex-girlfriend is kind of still glaring at me, and I notice that the baby has a zipper up the back of its head. And I realized that the baby actually has a mask on that has a computer chip that's only making the baby look smart. And so that so I woke up, the dream ended on the moment of, should I tell her? So that became a story.
Thank you so much. There's a quote of yours from the end of the essay, The New Mecca, that I think about all the time as advice for writing and advice for living, and if people haven't read it, I'm going to read it. That's an awful thing to do to you. I'm sorry. But don't be afraid to be confused. Try to remain permanently confused. Anything is possible. Stay open forever, so open it hurts, and then open up some more until the day you die, world without end. Amen. How do you do that? How do you do that? Every time I read anything, you're doing that, and I don't understand how you do it as a writer and as a human, especially with some of the topics that you canvas in your work.
Well, thank you. I don't, actually. I mean, in that piece, if I remember that right, there's a bit of a disclaimer right before it that says, I think self-righteously or grandiosely. But I mean, that's the aspiration. But the only way that I ever do it is it sounds stupid, but by revision, actually. Because as a person, I'm a, nothing. Like, I'm really, very negative and very stupid. But then when in the world of revising, you can slow it down, and you can write a stupid sentence and then go, well, huh, and come back day after day until you actually pry yourself open with this sentence revision. So that's the goal, I think, to just always be, in rewriting, it's enacted because you write on Wednesday and it's perfect. Then on Thursday, if you at least will entertain the possibility that it's not perfect anymore, then there's hope. You keep, so yeah, but thank you. I mean, I love that passage. I just wish that I, could do it.
I was just wondering, did you find the process of writing a novel more difficult compared to essays or short stories? And if so, in what respects?
Yeah, I kept waiting for it to be more difficult, and it really wasn't even different, to be honest with you. I make the joke that my whole life I've been building custom yurts, and someone said, hey, could you build a mansion? You're like, no, yeah, I could just put a bunch of yurts together, So it wasn't, because I think, one of the things I've noticed, and this is serious, kind of like as a writing nugget, I think you can take almost all narrative art and reduce it to a pretty simple riff, which is the writer says something, makes a statement, the statement goes into the reader's mind, and it opens up some possibilities. So if I say, once upon a time there was a dog with two heads. Well, first of all, you notice that you don't say, no, there wasn't. You say, all right, come on. All right, so then I say that. Then, if we could survey the room, actually, we're all kind of have a little curiosity, like, oh, that's, huh. And you might be thinking things like, are the heads identical? Do they get along? What's going on in the rectum area? What does mealtime look like? But basically, everybody essentially comes up with a certain set of questions. Jim walked in to find his wife Penelope having sex with Rod. And we're like, oh, poor Jim, And Jim is just a noun. There's nothing to it, So I think the basic fictive riff is, let me say something. It goes into your mind, and then I'm watching you to know what you're curious about. And then I deliver on that. And the only two sins are, I deliver too neatly, and you get disappointed, or I deliver so randomly that you get disappointed. So, you're halfway through a Christmas carol. If Dickens all of a sudden, makes space aliens come in, you're like, Charles, that's not what we were talking about, So in a sense, the novel was just that movement enacted just for a longer time, really. And that was a kind of a weird moment when I realized I wasn't going to kick into some different writer just because it was a novel. Although, it might not be a novel. It's kind of a, you know, a lot of white space. And, you know. But I heard this great definition: a novel is a long work of prose that has something wrong with it. Mm. So I think I did that.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Just thank you for your work. I was reading it in bed the other night, getting very empathetic to people. I just wanted to ask, in 10th of December, at the end, the man finds some sort of will to live through circumstances, you know, random circumstances. And at the end of the story, we're left feeling very empathetic towards him and his life with a terminal illness. I was wondering, what is your will to live right now?
9.6?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, when you were not a successful, like a famous successful writer, yeah, working with children, a wife, you know, you were working as a copywriter, mm-hmm, an editor, what made you want to write when you got home? You know, I get home and I'm tired, I'm pissed off, I'm hungry. What got you through that and to the page every day?
Yeah.
And what is your will to live now?
You have 4 seconds. 9.7 now, but it went up just a little bit. I think you're a working writer. Yeah. I think at that point, honestly, we just didn't have a lot of other options. I was working as a tech writer, and it seemed like, I didn't have any other skills, and actually didn't really care about much else. I cared about my family and writing, and that was it. And I think I was kind of naive enough to think, you know, that I could make a life from it. So, but I think one of the things, that crazy period between, when you're still working, you're trying to write. And the one advice I would give you is that you can kind of give yourself a present of saying it is actually possible to write in small increments. You know, if you could write a third of a page a day even, that's kind of good, you know. So I think a lot of my students, a lot of them come out of grad school traumatized because now they have to go to work. And the idea is you can't get a six-hour block of writing. That's true, you can't. But maybe you could, you know, I think during that time I was writing it, an engineering job, and I kind of just thought there are going to be days when you're only going to get 12 minutes. Are you going to use it or not? You know. So I had this whole system. I had it was WordPerfect was the system, and Shift F3 was the toggle screen thing. So I figured out ergonomically where to put the desk so that the boss would have the maximum number of steps to get behind me, and then I would just sit there, and I had would put a story up on one screen and a work document on the other, and then just toggle. And the trick was, there's also a facial expression toggle. So I'd be writing, yes, yes. And then when they came in, I'd just go. Like that, yeah. But you can actually get work done in small increments, I think, you know. I'll tell you one other story about, and this is when I was young, I was a roofer in Chicago, living in my aunt's basement, just circling the drain, or not actually circling, I was just going down it. And I decided that the reason I wasn't writing anything good is because I hadn't lived enough. That was why. So I thought, I'll go to El Salvador and cover the war. So I had no money, I didn't speak Spanish, I hadn't done zero journalism, but this was my big plan. So I'm ready to go. I'm not ready to go. I'm going to the public library every day reading, studying Spanish, like, ¿Dónde está la war? You know, I went to see a friend, this guy I'd known since second grade, love the guy, asked for some advice. He's not home, but his father is home, and his father is a, he has 9 kids, south side of Chicago, Catholic guy. Been a short-haul truck driver his whole life, and I'd never spoken a word to him. So I say, is so-and-so home? He said, no, he's not home. And then he steps out as if to have an adult conversation with me. He says, so what are you doing these days? I said, well, you know, I want to be a writer, and, in this neighborhood, that was like saying you wanted to be a cosmonaut or something. It was just, you know, I said, I'd like to be a writer. He said, is that your dream? I said, yeah, it is. He said, well, you better do it then. I said, yeah, yeah. He said, you know why? No. If you don't, you know who you're going to blame, right? I said, yeah, myself. He goes, bullshit, you'll blame your wife and kids. but that's golden, you know? And I mean, maybe, it, because basically, if you're in a situation where you have a family and you have an artistic aspiration, I think you kind of do owe it to them to get it out of your system. Even if it doesn't succeed, you're a better person if you tried and failed than if you didn't. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, good luck.
We could, I'm sure, spend a lot more time listening to you, George. It's been a great pleasure
and
a privilege.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And in rather dark times in that part of the world, it's wonderful to have you here and giving us hope.
Oh, thank you.
We know that there are millions and millions of Americans who are not Donald Trump. And
most of us, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A large cohort. And so would you please thank George for coming tonight.
Thank you. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.